Hey, everybody, let's have an AA meeting. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey, family, my name is Alonzo Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. And it's a real honor. It's a real treat for me this evening. I get to sit here and be here and watch a good friend and sponsee celebrate a little time in the program, 6 years, and that would be Mike C. in the back. Let's hear it. And as fortune would have it, well, first let me read this. I'm going to introduce tonight's speaker, and I've been told to read this. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal story is described in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, we hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. We were supposed to have a speaker here. Let's hope and pray that she's all right. And she couldn't make it. So the treat we have is that I get to introduce another sponsee of mine, James J. He has about 21 months. He's worked the steps. And you know, what's happened, like with Mike, you know, that sponsor-sponsee relationship can evolve into a friendship. And I have a lot of respect for both men, and I know that you're going to enjoy hearing James tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I give you James J.
We do this, but we're going to give it a try anyway.
I'm James J. My clean date is April 4th, 2015. What happened? Well, if I can go back a little bit, I can go back to Athens, Georgia, Madison County, Georgia. My grandmother, grandfather, all those guys used to make what they call homebrew. You northerners might not know anything about that. But homebrew was kind of this little girly drink that, you know, it was homemade, but it could get you, it could tear you down pretty quick. So my grandparents would mind us kids to enjoy a little bit of that homebrew. So that's my early experience as far as drinking goes, and I think I started that when I was maybe about 7, 8 years old. At the time, my parents actually lived in Mobile, Alabama. So during the summer, my mom and dad was bringing us to Madison County, Georgia, so we could spend that time with our grandparents while they went back down to Mobile, Alabama and did whatever they did when we wasn't around. But my father was a drunk. The earliest I can remember, he was a drunk. But I can remember back in when we did live in Alabama, my mom was one time waiting behind the door with her .38. And since my dad was a drunk, he spent a lot of time away from home, away from the kids. And she had gotten fed up with it, so she decides once he walks in the door, she was going to pop him in the head with a .38. I must have been maybe about 6 at the time, so I kind of like caught wind of what her intentions were. So when he walked in, I kind of like pushed her. She shot us around up into the ceiling, and that's how my family actually worked. I mean, I have 3 brothers, 3 sisters, and I'm like the 4th child of all of that. And something happened in Alabama. I don't really know, but one night, it's dark. My parents pack us all up, and we move from Alabama to Georgia. Athens, Georgia, as a matter of fact, and lived with our grandma and grandpa for a long period of time until my dad actually found a job and was able to work at, I don't know if you guys, Kendall Fiberglass. If you know, they do a lot of, make fiberglass insulation for homes. That's where he worked in Athens, Georgia. And only thing that I really remember about my father is that at that time was that what he did was went to work and got drunk. Went to work and got drunk. And I don't know if that's a functional drunk or not, but he would go to work, and whenever he was come home, he would just come home, park the car. He was even driving. Park the car, get out of the car, head up to the step, and normally he would pass out in the yard. This little story happened once. I mean, I was so upset with my father. He had went out and bought like maybe 30 little chickens. You know, my mom was going to raise chickens and all this type of thing. And this is 1970, around about 1970 or so. He went out and bought like a couple flats of chickens. I think it was about 30 of them. And there was something that he was supposed to have given me some money for, and he had drank that up. So I decided I was going to take a water hose and kill all these chickens, and that's what I did. I took a water hose, I went to the pen, and I just sprayed until I killed all the chickens. That wasn't a good day. The retribution that my parents put on me after that, I don't think I ever made too many more mistakes like that since then. But back to my father, he was, this is my start in alcohol to remember. He decided when we lived in Athens that he wanted to go out and mess around. My mom and my dad, we lived in an apartment complex called Brooklyn down in Athens. And he moved to one house, and my mom lived in another. I mean, I stayed with my mom, some of the kids with my father. And he just basically got to a point where he just never showed back up one time. And come to find out about 3 months later, he had moved in with another lady across town. So my brothers, I had 2 brothers and a sister that went with him. And he just left. And we all ended up getting back together. We all lived with my mom. And once we found out, you know, he just stopped any type of support or anything like that. So I don't know if you guys know anything about being poor, but we were dirt poor. I can recall we lived in a house at one time where we fed the dog through a hole in the floor. During the winter time, we would have blankets and everything, and we all would sleep in this one bed. We all would put these blankets on it. We didn't have one running water, no electricity. It was a guy that had a house directly behind us. We ran a electrical cord from his house just to make it, just to stay warm. When it comes time to wash clothes, we all would take our clothes, warm water up through this electric oven that we had, or electric stove, and we'd pour the water in the bathtub, and we would take turns stuffing the clothes to get them clean. At some point, my dad started having some serious medical problems after that, and he moved back in with my mom and all of us. You know, we tried to take care of him. One time, I can remember where my dad was pretty bad off. The alcohol didn't start really taking effect on him. And he was in the bathroom, and I heard a boom. And I went inside, and he had blacked out and fell off the toilet and bust his head wide open. And that's when I started really noticing there was a problem with him drinking. About 3 months later, I don't know if you guys can recall, the Los Angeles Lakers was playing the Boston Celtics for the NBA championship. And this particular time, this is when Magic Johnson, wasn't much time left on the clock. Magic Johnson went down to the top of the key and threw this hook shot over Parrish, Bird, and McHale, and that's allowed the Lakers to win that championship. As soon as that happened, my dad said, well, he wasn't drinking alcohol. He was drinking blueberry wine, I think it was. And he asked me, he said, will you go downstairs and get me some wine? And I was looking at his cup, and it was still half full. And I'm like, can we watch the rest of this game? And he said, no, I need you to go get me some wine. So, you know, I tried to rush downstairs, pour the wine for him, head back upstairs. When I got back upstairs, his last breath was going out of his body. I heard that breath, last on the air. He died that night. And after that, it was pretty much a struggle for my family since then. I graduated high school in June of 81, and I went into service in August of 81. And I wasn't much of a drinker. I recall when I was playing football, the first time I got drunk was when we was headed to the state championship game. We had a party just before, and I recall crawling into the house after the fact. And that's the, you know, what, 1976, somewhere around, 1975, 76. And that's my first drunk. That was the first time that I couldn't walk and threw up and the room was spinning and all these things was going on. And I was determined that I wouldn't be like my father. So I graduated high school. I went into the Army. And once I got into the Army, it was party time. With alcohol and all the other things that we could possibly buy. Because, you know, back when the time when I went into service in 81, alcohol and all those drugs wasn't really a problem as far as how the military looked at it at the time. So we would sit at in the barracks over, during the weekend, and we would all bring all our things, alcohol, beer. You know, and it was so cheap. I mean, I was 19 years old. I probably wasn't old enough to drink, but we drank anyway. You know, the military didn't have a problem with it. They just didn't want us doing anything too crazy. And all that went fine and dandy, just drinking, enjoying ourselves, drinking, enjoying ourselves. But I never would get drunk. I would get close. I think light beer, you know, that you can't get drunk off of light beer. So I would take about 20, 25 of those, and everything is working just fine. About 1983, I came down on orders to go to Germany. Now the party really began then. Once I got over to Germany, I was in a Persian missile unit, and we was always on the, what they call a combat alert site. We was there for 3 months out of a year, and it was like closed in. You couldn't do anything but exercise and have alert drills for to power the power up those missiles to be launched. But after we left that cast site, we went straight home and got all the beer, got all the liquor, went into the rooms. And for the first few days after we got back from the cast site, it was free time. So all we would do is drink, among other things, but drinking was the big thing. I can recall this time during the summer where we went all got together and went to Munich, Germany, and the beer just wasn't, I mean, you know, German beer is really, really good, but we decided that we was going to get us some Thunderbird. Not cold Thunderbird, hot Thunderbird. And started to drink. As we was driving back from Munich, we started to drink. The driver didn't drink. And I never been so sick in my entire life after the fact. It was sort of like June time frame in Europe. It was hot outside. During the weekend, you know, it's not a lot of activity going on at base during the weekend. Everybody's either going home or everybody's doing their own thing. So I went back to the barracks and passed out. That's the first time I remember passing out that I really, when I woke up, I didn't really understand what had happened. But continue to drink. And I got promoted to sergeant. Sometime about 1985, 1986, and this is about the time frame where the Army really started to break to come down on NCOs, non-commissioned officers that would actually wouldn't be setting a good example for the troops by being an alcoholic and things like that. So there was one time where I had to do an actual breathalyzer. My commander gave me a breathalyzer while I was on duty, and I was drunk. Now, I was an NCO. Now, if I was an E4 below, it wouldn't have been no big deal, but I was an NCO. So what happened was they gave me a choice to take an Article 15, I was getting real close to deploying. I needed to re-enlist to go somewhere else, and I wasn't quite there. So I decided I was going to get out. So I got out on an honorable discharge and went back home and thought I would start life and try life again. And it didn't quite work. I can say that whenever all the problems that I've actually had in my life, it's come from drinking, and it's not. You know, I've just been fortunate enough. I drive real fast. I never killed anyone, not yet. I never harmed anyone, and that was my biggest fear of everything, that I was going to actually get behind a wheel one day in a car and hurt someone else, and I would just walk out of this thing unscathed. I was scared, but I tried to tailor my drink, and I can recall one time after I got out of the service, I lived in Alexandria, Virginia. I was married, and I can recall driving for about 20 miles from Woodbridge, Virginia, if anyone knows that place, up into Alexandria, on the top side of Alexandria. And when I got home, it scared me to death because I know it was on Route 1, if anyone knows, Route 1, it is probably 30 lights from Woodbridge to Alexandria. It's probably about 30 lights on Route 1. I got home and I didn't remember no lights. It's like I just left there and I was at home. And that scared me pretty bad then, you know. And but it didn't scare me enough that I stopped. You know, I figured I'd tailor out or I wouldn't drive on Route 1 anymore. But, you know, just crazy stuff, man. And all of a sudden discovered women, girls. You know, you have a few drinks, everything just gets out of hand. And I began to enjoy that kind of life. I was probably, when I got around 30 years old, I was married. Let's back up a little bit. I got married to a young lady. And back in the time when I was getting ready to be deployed overseas, I got married 1 year prior to having to go to Germany. I thought I was in love. At least I really thought that was the key. She was going to take all this nonsense away, and I was going to have a good life from that point forth. So I got to Florida, went to Germany. This is well before cast site or all that type of thing. So I went to Germany, and my thing was, once I get there, I go find housing, go find places to live. I'll send word back to my commander that the unit I just left or something like that. And they would cut orders for my wife to come over and join me in Germany. Well, once I got there and I found a place to live and everything was going just fine for me, I tried to call her up. And I must have been in country then about 3 months. I tried to call her up and I wasn't able to get anyone to answer the phone. I called her parents and they kind of like wasn't answering. So I decided I was going to take me a hop. Left Germany, went to England, went to Dover, Delaware, rented me a car, drove down to Alexandria, Virginia, and called my wife. She seemed to be so happy to hear from me. And I had this hotel, so I think, man, I haven't saw this girl in 3 months. We getting ready to get it on. And when she showed up at the hotel, she brought a friend with her. And that wasn't a good sign. Nothing was going to be happening then. So I just, you know, she wasn't too, and she seemed to be happy, but she wasn't all that enthused to see me. She brought this friend of hers along. And eventually, her and her friend left, and I stayed in the room, but I still didn't know what was actually going on. I had a rental car, and I had an idea where I knew where she worked. So one day after she did not take care of me when I was in that hotel, I went to a job. Well, it was about the time she got off, and I followed her. And she had moved back in with her ex-boyfriend. That's why I wasn't able to contact her when I was in Europe. And I never got so drunk in my life. I was going to show her. You did me wrong, so I'm gonna kill myself. I'm going to drink until I can't do anything else. My mother just so happened to call me in Athens, Georgia. She said, "Baby, where you at?" I said, "Mom, I'm up in Virginia." She said, "How's your wife?" And I said, "Well, I don't have a wife." She said, "I think you need to come home." So I dried up for a couple of days, and I drove down to Athens and got drunk some more. I don't know why. I mean, you know, like I just said, everything that I've ever done in life where I thought I was above water, I would have a drinking binge, and I would seem like I was lost for a long period after that. Went back, well, the wife and I eventually thought we would give it another try. And when I left service and came to Alexandria, Virginia, I lived with her parents there. Her father was a drinker, you know. He was the kind of a drinker that he always wanted to talk crap, you know. He had a good job. He had his own job, so he wanted me to work for him, and I was like, "No, I don't think I want to do that. You're drunk and all this." And he's like, "You're drunk too." You know, but I was fed up, and I wasn't going to be dealing with this stuff anymore. So the wife and I ended up getting a divorce, and I was working for the Department of Defense at the time. I was the Special Forces Schools Advisor at the time for the Department of Defense. And after about 3 years, I started to tail off. I was awarded once with Civilian of the Month, Civilian of the Quarter, Civilian of the Year, all in line. And after that, I started to have fun and drink again. The guy that I worked for was a Special Forces guy named Major Maverick or something like that. After this time, where I went to work one time, and he was like, "You need to go see a doctor." And I'm like, "I'm fine, I'm okay. I'm fine, I'm okay. I wasn't eating right, I wasn't doing anything right. So what I did was, I went to see the nurse at the building that I worked in. She came over, she did some tests here, tests there, and she just advised me it's probably a good thing if I go directly to the hospital. And I was like, "Okay, not a problem. I'm going to go directly to the hospital." I went out and got in my car, and I was going to get drunk. And I forgot my keys, so I went back upstairs, and the lady that ran the place up there, she said, "I need the keys. You can't go anywhere. You got to go to the hospital, and you got to go right now. I just talked to the nurse, and you're not in good shape." So they took me over to the hospital, and they took me up to this, I think at the time it was called the fourth floor, where all the crazy people went. So I go into this place, and they got me in this little bit of room, and they got this psychiatrist coming in and talk with me. And I'm thinking, you know what, actually, after all this, and my blood pressure's up, you know, my heart is beating erratically and all these things, I'm sitting in there talking about, why am I here? What's wrong with what I'm doing? Why am I here? And I end up staying on that fourth floor for maybe about 12 days. They were sure I was going to go out and kill myself. And all that stuff kind of like, after my commander actually sent me to the hospital, I never stopped drinking after that. I was really going to show this that I can work, function okay, and do this job very, very professionally. Didn't work that way. There was one time when I went on leave from there. I had 30 days of leave. Instead of using that to go and do something, like go home and see my family, I would have bought about 3 big old fifths of alcohol. 3 big ones. And for this 30 days that I was going to be on leave, that I was going to actually spend some time in Athens and go up to Maryland and see my brothers, things like that, I just got drunk for all that time. I mean, pissing drunk. And when I went on leave, I don't recall ever taking a shower. I recall getting drunk, passing out, waking up the next day, try to eat something, and I couldn't, get drunk, pass out, and that went on for probably about 15, 16 days in a row. My commander, the civilian lady that ran the department of DOD at the time, she came down to see me and she said, you can't come back to work. So I resigned my position at the time from there, and that was in 2005 or so. I resigned my position and I packed my car and I moved to Athens to live with my mother. And that time that I was telling you about from when my father died and all the houses that we had with no electricity, no food, and all those type of things, I moved back into a situation like that with her. Her health wasn't that good, and it seemed like the kids who, when they decided they don't want to do anything in life, they would just go and bomb around my mother and all that thing, and it kind of like used to piss me off. It really pissed me off. So I had to answer again. I'm going to go and get me a bottle and get drunk, and I can just forget about it all. And none of those things worked. I mean, I bought about 3 cars when I left in 2005 when I got back down to my mother's house. And the only thing I can recall doing is just finding a place to get drunk. I read around, I guess, about 2006, my sister came, and I hadn't saw her. She lived across town, and I hadn't saw her. Whenever she would come around my mother, I would kind of like break out the back door, run and hide, things like that. And then one day she caught me on the street, and she asked me, she said, "What are you just standing around ready to die?" And that really hurt. You know, this is the sister that always gave me support regardless of what I was doing. And when she said that to me, this is the first time that I actually went into any type of recovery, anything like that. So at Athens, in Athens, Georgia, they call it behavioral science. I went there, and in order to get into this place, I had to pay $300, and I didn't have a dime. So my uncle gave me $300, and I'm excited. I'm getting ready to go into recovery. So I was supposed to be there on a Friday. He gave me that money on a Wednesday morning, and I went out and had another band and got drunk. You know, I actually ended up going into that behavioral science place with only like $100, and that's only because I had given to my mom to hold it for me. I went there and I got a taste of sobriety that, you know, I was locked up in this place. They rolled us around in a bus everywhere we went, prepared our own food. We went through classes, and at the time I had no idea that this was actually considered to be an illness. At the time I was just thinking I was crazy. You know, I just was tired of living, tired of life. I just was going to end it all. And I actually left there in Athens, Georgia, once I got through the behavioral science after 30 days. And there was a company in Atlanta over there off Memorial Drive at the time. It was called the Phoenix Alliance. And I got accepted into the Phoenix Alliance. And I came here and, you know, just left Athens. I've never been to Atlanta before, only to catch an airplane. I never actually lived there. So I went to Phoenix Alliance, and, you know, after a few days where I wasn't working like I wanted to do, I decided I was going to go get drunk again. And they ended up putting me out of that place. Just so happened that I found out that if I was a soldier, a veteran, I can go over to the VA hospital. They'll give me some help there. And that must have been about early 2006, middle 2006, that time frame. When I went there, they actually found me a place, and I was living. You may know some guys that's been around here. They sent me over to Focus. There's a lot of guys that come through here from that place called Focus over there. They sent me there, and I was doing just fine there for a while. And after the 30 days was over, they decided, I mean, I had a little income coming in, but I didn't have enough income coming in that I wanted to give it to these guys at Focus. So I decided I'm going to go back out and just, I'm going to find me a place to live, find me a roommate, and everything is going to be okay. So I did that, you know, and was drunk the very same day I left there. Everything that I've done, everything that, you know, I can't complain about life, but every time there was a wrinkle that didn't turn out too well, it was because of my drinking. Let's say about in 2006, this is the first time where I heard anything about a 12-step or anything like that. Before, I just thought I was just going to have to wean myself off of it and do the best that I can. And that was the first time that I actually ran into my sponsor now, Alonzo. And that was, he was having book studies and all this stuff that, you know, and I thought I had it made. I thought this was my way out, is to actually do those steps. Then I got a call from, when I was in Focus, from this girl that I've had a relationship with when I was in Virginia. I never told him that, but I decided it was time to go. And I was gone. Not actually, I didn't go back to Virginia. She didn't come here, but I thought I could do it again. I thought I was okay now, I could do it again. That didn't work out at all. I ended up going back to Focus again, another 30 days. I left out of there. Then I think I was here one day, and we had a meeting, and some guy said something to the effect of, you know, when you first get out of recovery, the first time you leave a recovery house, what you want to do is go to a meeting as soon as you leave. I did that, and I really, really liked it. And then I decided to get drunk again. And this is going to be about, I'm going to say, what, 2016? I'm going to say it was around about 2014, sometime around about there, where I moved again from a recovery house until I got my own place. And I had a car then, man. You couldn't tell me nothing. Man. Nothing was going to go wrong anymore. Found me a little job, you know, and everything was going just fine. And the next thing you know, I continued to get drunk, and I was not able to make my car payments. I went out one day to get ready to go get me another fifth, and they found out that my damn car was gone. Now, that was my car. The lien company or the bank or all those people, they had no right to come and get my car. Even though I hadn't paid any type of a note for the past 5 months. They came and got it, and I went out and got drunk, and you know, I ended up getting so bad in this drunk stupor that I was in at the time. I went over to the hospital, and I started developing problems with my blood. I'm diabetic and high cholesterol and all these things going on. And everything went cool. I met this woman over at the hospital, and I moved in with her, and everything was going fine. And one day she decides, she's got a master's degree in nursing, but she would always be broke. Like, once she gets paid, the creditors was going to her account and take this stuff. And she told me once, I said, you know, all you have to do is go over to this place and sign an allotment, and you can have this money taken out and sent to your creditors, and these people won't bother you. And she says to me, well, you know I love you, but I have a master's degree. You have a high school diploma. There's no way I'm going to listen to you. To this day, she's still having the same problems. The last time that I went to the hospital, I thought to myself before I went there that if I can actually find Alonzo, I have a choice. I have a chance that I could possibly make it. And I was at the Peachwood Hospital after about 4 days. And with this thought in my head that I can make it if I can meet Alonzo, because when he was my sponsor before, I felt like everything was getting back in order or some type of order. I went to Peachwood Hospital, and I went into the gym one day for a meeting, and after I knew in my heart I had to find Alonzo Johnson, and he was at that meeting. That was April 6th, somewhere around about there of 2015. And I remember the guy said when he told me that the first thing I needed to do once I leave a recovery house, anything like that, is to go to a meeting. I got Alonzo's phone number. I left there and I went to a meeting. And I went over to a place called, I don't know the name of it. No, Fox Recovery is where I was at when I was actually, after I left the Petra Hospital, I went to Fox Recovery, which is for veterans, veteran men. And after I had, you know, I'm not trying to blow no smoke up Alonzo's tail or anything like that. So, but I, once we talked there, and, you know, he was having, you know, he said, you know, everything can, it's not always going to be fine. Everything is not always fine for me. But I looked at this guy and everything worked for him, as far as I knew. But we was all having our difficulties at the time. And I left Fox and I went into a place called Hugs Recovery. Hugs Recovery is where I'm at right now. I got over to Hugs in April of 2015. And that's where my life really changed that, you know. I began to work some steps. I began to really, really thinking that God had saved me this time. And since he saved me, I may as well do the right things and start trying to show some honor and some thank you to God. And my sponsor told me one time, he said, before, it'd probably be a good idea that before you do anything, since you're trying now to make another contact with, to make a contact with God, a special bond with God now, before you do anything, just ask yourself a question. What would God have me do? And I don't know about the what happened and where I'm at, but I'm just gonna finish this. Once I got over to Hugs Recovery, I started actually doing some steps and trying to be of service and just trying to do the next right thing. I'm not always successful at it, but that's still how I carry myself today. I've been at Hugs Recovery now for about 21 months, and I was getting ready to leave Hugs Recovery about 2 months ago. And the owner brought me into his office and he said, I'm going to offer you a job. So I am now the site supervisor for a house of 6 recovering alcoholics and drug guys. And what I do every day is what I do is I try to ask myself, what would God have me do? I'm not going to do anything to anyone that's going to cause anyone to stumble. That thing I had about myself, I never wanted to harm anyone else with all of my silliness and all my craziness. That's how I live my life now. I don't have a lot of money. I volunteer at a place called, I volunteer at a place over on Hollywood Road. And I think that's probably one of the better decisions that I actually made. Because these people over in the West End are really, really in trouble as far as life, a lot of drugs. The place is basically run down. There's no more money over in that area, anything like that. And I think that was one of the greatest decisions that I ever made, because I really think that I can actually have an impact on someone else's life and not just continue to destroy myself. The house that I'm in right now, I had a meeting past Sunday. And what we talked about was, God saved all of us in my house. There's 7 there total with me. God saved all of us, so we are responsible. Let's try to be responsible to the point where we start showing some honor to God, honor to your fellow man, and be of service. Not just to yourself. All that selfishness and all that silly things that we used to do a long time ago, it don't apply anymore. If we still allow these things that used to hold us down to continue to do those silly, crazy, dumb things that I've done all my life and they've done a lot of their lives, we was going to end up having to go back to focus and all these type of things and start over. But I can honestly say that I really feel now that I've gotten a head start. I've gotten a head start in life that I'm no longer afraid of nothing. Dying is, I never had a problem with dying or anything like that. But I'm trying to live now. I'm trying to live, and I want to be, to everyone that I cross their path, I want them to know that God saved me, and He could possibly save you too. I don't know what order that was in, but that is my story. I just figured that out about 15 minutes prior to me coming into this room. But my sponsor says maybe God talking. Maybe it is. And if He talks, I'm going to listen. That's my story, guys. I appreciate you guys listening to it. I'm gone.
And that's a God thing. James, you walked in the door tonight, and we needed him, and he delivered. Amen. Tinsley's going to come back and replay our chips for us this week.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks, James. That was a great story. I got a lot out of it. And thanks for stepping up to the plate last minute. That would scare the hell out of me. I tell you what, you did better than good. You did great. Anyway, here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody like to pick up a white chip and join this way of life? One day at a time. After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Who's got 3 months? 90-day chip. We have a yellow chip for 6 months. Anybody got 9 months? A green chip. I know we have one birthday we know about. Is there any birthdays we don't know about? And I'm going to get Mike and Alonzo to come up here right now for a special presentation.
I know y'all are either tired of seeing me up here, or but thank your God and your sponsor, because I'm back. And this man here, Mike, is celebrating 6 years. I first met Mike at a halfway house treatment facility, and he was a resident there, and I worked there, and we had to get people up in the morning, right, at 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. That's what we were supposed to do. That was part of my job. I avoided Mike's house, and I avoided Mike's room because I was scared of Mike.
Lots of people said that.
You know, it must be true. Whoever that person was then is not the person who's standing here and picking up this symbol of what he and God has been able to do. Not only is he a sponsee, but he's also my friend. And that's probably even more important. And there are times, you know, that sponsee thing, if it's really clicking, it can switch. Right? And sometimes the sponsee becomes a sponsor. And that's certainly been my experience with Mike, and I'm so happy and proud. And I give him this little symbol. And not only is he sober, he's also, he has a master plan of a project to help other alcoholics and addicts. And this may not be the place to mention it, but I am. It's called Portable Sober Living. And it's an incredible program. So get to know this man. If you need some help on any level, here's the man to see. Thank you, Mike.
Everybody, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. This is six. I've always had some kind of master plan. It's just now it's legal, and there's no arrests and no buildings blowing up and stuff like that. That's the biggest thing. I got sober right here in this room. The treatment center that I was at, that Alonzo worked at. Alonzo was being very kind when he talked about when I met him. You know, I was just sick beyond belief. I had just gotten out of Peachford Hospital. It's just amazing how sick we can get. And in this room here, this was the first room where somebody looked me in the eyes and shook my hand and called me Mike and remembered my name and asked me, you know, how I was doing. I came to that 11 o'clock meeting every single day, 5 or 6 days a week. The treatment center brought me here. And I just kept coming back and coming back and doing what people like Alonzo said to do. And it started to click. And Alonzo showed me the way. Guys like Tinsley, Tim, you know, have showed me the way. You know, God's in charge. I don't know what's going to happen. I start every day and I just ask for the clarity to show me what's going to be done. You know, give me enough sense to see what God's will is and you know, give me enough strength to do it. Usually it's fairly clear. Sometimes it's not. But it's a whole hell of a lot better than it was 6 years ago. It's a lot clearer than it was then. And like I said, now the plans are legal. So, you know, even better. But anyway, thanks a lot, guys. I appreciate it.
Any other birthdays? Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Big hand for the chips you hold.
Well, my head was in tomorrow, and my feet followed history. I had an insane notion I could hoodoo everything around me. No. 'Cause too much of everything ain't enough for nothing to me. I got a nudge from the judge, Lord, and put me in recovery. Put the plug in the jug. Man, I feel like I've been set free. Oh, too much of it.